oh, we ain't got dough, and oh, ho, ho, there ain't no paint on the bungalow. What of it? We love it.
Coming up, the late Tiny Tim, the eccentric singer who was immersed in the pop music of earlier eras. His recording, Tiptoe Through the Tulips, became a hit in 1968. The CD box, God Bless Tiny Tim, collects his recordings. And David Edelstein reviews the new documentary, The War Tapes.
At 9 p.m., we lock the door. We've got each other and nothing more. What of it? We love it. Poor as a mouse, but in our house, you'll find lots and lots of happiness. Sunshine or rain, we don't complain. If we ain't got more, we do on land. Oh, we bought a car and how it squeaks. A dollar down every 7 weeks. What of it?
We love it. We hang our wash upon a tree. The neighbors give it the raspberry. What of it?
We love it. Our next door neighbors are the biggest hearted souls. And they don't holler when they miss the milk and rolls. Milk and rolls.
We write our checks in white and black. We send them out, but they bounce right back. What of it?
We love it.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross.
My dear friends, I want you to listen to the chorus of this song, and on the second time around, gather all your friends and neighbors and join in. Let them sing.
There's a light shining bright in a little cabin window down Virginia way. And they say every night when the night shadows fall, Mother's light through the night seemed to call to her wandering son. When his wandering is done, please come home to stay. For a light still burns in a little cabin window down Virginia way. Down Virginia way.
That is, of course, Tiny Tim. Most people who remember Tiny Tim write him off as an eccentric one-hit wonder. The hit was Tiptoe Through the Tulips, which he warbled in his falsetto voice, accompanying himself on the ukulele. But he had a great passion and knowledge about the music of earlier eras. Radio host Barry Hanson, otherwise known as Dr. Demento, was a champion of Tiny Tim. He wrote, "How ironic that Tiny Tim should be a one-hit wonder, seeing as he was a man of 1,000 songs. Make that 10,000. He had an encyclopedic knowledge of American popular music from the 1880s to the 1950s, and could sing most anything you asked for right on the spot, with a perfect feel for the song, the era it came from, and the singers who sang it back then." That's from an essay included in the new box set God Bless Tiny Tim, featuring the three albums Tiny Tim recorded for Reprise Records in the late 60s. It's just been released in a limited edition by Rhino Records. Tiny Tim died on stage of heart failure in 1996. He was 64 years old. Just a few months before his death, he recorded this interview and performance on Fresh Air.
Tiny Tim, welcome to Fresh Air.
Good afternoon, it's Terry Gross. It's tight. Glad to speak to you and your wonderful show.
Now, let me play a song from the new CD that's more in your period. More, I guess this is a turn-of-the-century song, and it's called Sly Cigarette. Tell me
my
about this song, how you found it.
That was my darling wife, Miss Sue's favorite. The song was sung in 1898 by S.H. Dudley, one of the great cylinder stars of his day. I got this in a collection of cassette tapes from Mr. Dulo, a great historian who passed away a few years ago in Florida. And I thought the song was another great melody and also a message song. Even though it was 1898, it was a shock to see a woman smoking.
Let's hear Sly Cigarette. And this is Tiny Tim from his new album, Girl.
Oh, you poor little cigarette, how they're stomping and crushing you today. They're taking advantage of your small little nature. They're blaming you for cancer when you can still get cholesterol from butter and fat from lard and bacon and all these meats and cheeses that are causing heart attacks and tumors. Why are they picking on you, oh
sly cigarette. It's not fair. Somebody has to protest and get back to normality again. When I have to pretend, but I don't, you know. Oh, sly cigarette, yes. Oh, fine cigarette, what is it? Why did you teach me to love you so? When I have to pretend that I don't, you know.
And my guest is Tiny Tim. So tell me, do you sing in a falsetto anymore?
Yes, right now, it's in the afternoon. This needs a lot of warm-up. I'll just see if I can even do a poor version of...
Oh, tiptoe through the tulips with me.
And how did you discover your falsetto voice?
Well, I thank Jesus Christ for every gift, because I really prayed about it one day. And about 1952, I needed something to differentiate myself from better singers at the time, especially from Tony Bennett, Perry Como, Guy Mitchell. And so every entertainer, every artist, every comedian, every broadcaster should have a sound, an originality in the voice that the mass can identify with singly. And so originality is the key to success. You can close your eyes and know it's Louis Armstrong, know it's Bing Crosby, and the same thing, you know, it's Tiny Tim if I do tiptoe, whatever. And so that's what I looked for. That's what I got. And from 54 on, it proved to be successful.
Now, back in the 50s, before you were famous, how did you dress when you performed?
Another good question. Well, I had a usual shirt and tie and suit jacket. I didn't start wearing costumes until... 68, 69, and Mr. Sharp in Australia made me unbelievable costumes after that. But when you went to amateur nights, you always had a suit and tie on.
Short hair?
Yeah, until 54. Then everything changed. Not only did the hair become long, which I took a little bit from Rudolph Valentino. Mr. Valentino, in his book that he wrote in 1923, and he had his hair parted one way over the eyebrow. I wanted mine the other way. And the only difference is that while long hair was here since day one, the difference here is that I had white-faced makeup with it throughout the day, not just for show business. And the white-faced, whatever Jolson did to blackface, it happened here with white-face and the long hair. So that in 1954 and 55 and 56... in the years that President Eisenhower was here and the McCarthy hearings were ending, I mean, that was a rough thing to look at 24 hours a day.
You said you were wearing the white makeup not just for show business.
That's right.
What were the other reasons?
Another good question, Ms. Gross. First of all, since I was not good looking and I didn't want to cut this nose off, I was afraid of operations, I've always wanted to appeal to certain type of women I liked. Everyone has their dreams of what they want. And, of course, the hair was too short. So when I wore the makeup, I should also state that I still cleanse today about 8 to 12 times a day and use night creams and eye creams and throat creams and, of course, light makeup. But at that time, I wanted to also appeal to the women, even if they said, oh, I can't stand them. Look at that ugly thing in the subway trains. At least they were paying attention. So part of it was for show business, and part of it was to live within myself and be content. And it started to work on both fronts. On the amateur nights, I was starting to win under Larry Love in the 50s, and in the subway trains around the neighborhood, they were all looking. And the high voice also became, believe it or not, appealing to especially the girls who listened to me. Whether it was funny or grotesque, it still was appealing. At least they paid attention. And so that's the difference.
Excuse this cheap bit of psychoanalysis.
Go right ahead.
But it seems to me, in a way, what you're saying is that you felt unattractive, you felt like a freak. And so to transcend that, you kind of turned yourself into a freak by putting on makeup and growing your hair long.
Well, I was unattractive. I didn't think I was. I was a very ugly person when it came to looks. They looked at it as a freak, you know, with the white makeup. And the world looked at it that way. The world looked at the hair like that, and especially in the 50s, the middle 50s. But inside one's heart, I felt that I was especially wearing white makeup, not dark makeup, because white seemed, I've always looked at the princesses that I adored in my dreams to be equal with the white light, beautiful springtime. And I wanted to feel within me, with the songs and everything, that I had a sensuality with the women I liked. I don't know if I can explain it that way. And by wearing this light makeup, I felt even with myself by keeping clean. I've always looked at women as clean objects who wash their hands all the time with soap, who take care of their bodies and never offend.
So the white makeup gave you a sense of purity and cleanliness.
Beautifully put. Beautifully analyzed, yes.
Do you still wear it?
Well, it's not as white as it is, but it's whitish today.
Tiny Tim recorded in 1996. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. In 2003, Deborah Scranton declined an offer from the New Hampshire National Guard to be an embedded journalist in Iraq. Instead, the former TV reporter trained soldiers themselves to be cinematographers and kept in touch with them by email. The result, The War Tapes, won the Best Documentary Prize at this year's Tribeca Film Festival. Film critic David Edelstein, who was a member of that jury, has a review.
In the 60s, the critic Michael Arlen called Vietnam the living room war because TV brought the bloodshed into people's homes. But even with today's small light cameras, TV reporters in Iraq have been hamstrung when it comes to getting close to the action, first by government restrictions on their movements, then by the escalating danger of being kidnapped or blown up by roadside bombs. The director Deborah Scranton found a way around the problem in 2004. With the approval of the National Guard, she supplied several guardsmen stationed in Iraq with mini DVD cameras, along with tripods to mount them on vehicles. The upshot, The War Tapes, is among the most revelatory documentaries of the Iraq War years. This isn't raw cinema verite. Scranton and her team edited more than 1,000 hours of tape down to a taut hour and a half. And the film's 96-minute running time includes interviews with family and friends back home. Yet the movie gives you a sense both of the dread of waiting for the violence to erupt and the panic of actual engagement. Although several guardsmen sent back footage, Scranton focuses on just three. Sergeant Steve Pink is a carpenter and an aspiring writer.
Every once in a while, as we're driving down the road, creeping along on patrol, I have a reoccurring epiphany. This is happening and will have a lasting impact on me for the rest of my life. A debate we had earlier in the day over the consistency and texture of a severed limb was not some far-off grotesque assumption. It was a genuine argument between the guy who swears it resembles hamburger, ground up but uncooked, and the guy who believes it looks more like a raw pot roast. There is no argument, however, that human intestines are pink pork sausage links, if, of course, you imagine a butcher's block as the background instead of the screaming, then soon quietly moaning casualty.
The second subject, Specialist Mike Moriarty, is a gung-ho patriot who cites September 11th and the lives of his kids as reasons for going to Iraq, and who sometimes mouths nukem platitudes to stay revved up, even when confronted by Iraqi police instead of insurgents.
Come on, because I dare you to shoot just once. Come on, keep going, brother. You want to play? They're shooting at me. I don't give a fuck if they're the Pope.
Sergeant Zach Bazzi is the more inscrutable specimen, a Lebanese-American whose doting mother brought him to the U.S. from what was, she says, the worst place on earth, and who enlisted to go to another as soon as he came of age. She can't understand it, and neither can he fully. There's little talk about why the Americans are in Iraq, only that, according to Zach, they've been taught next to nothing about the culture of the people whose country they occupy. The war tapes portrays day-to-day life in a world without a compass. A soldier carves a wooden pistol because he's not allowed to carry a real one. Guardsmen express irritation with Halliburton subsidiary Kellogg Brown & Root, which runs all the American stores and charges hefty amounts for paper plates of bad food. We don't see anyone hit by bullets, but the camera is on the fringes when a convoy comes upon an IED, an improvised explosive device. Because of the Geneva Convention, the only footage the director couldn't show was of the dead insurgents from that battle. But we see plenty of bodies of civilians. In the film's most haunting scene, the camera surveys pieces of a young woman who made the mistake of crossing a road on which American trucks barrel recklessly along. A soldier says he watched helpless as she was knocked unconscious by one truck and then turned into, well, it looked to me like hamburger. But that description isn't his. He's weeping that his people have just killed someone they were sent there to protect. When the three guardsmen return to the U.S., Scranton just scratches the surface of the scars they bear, in part out of respect for men who revealed so much already, in part because not a lot needs to be said. The war tapes make the case not that war is hell, but that this war is a corrosive mixture of hell and purgatory, with carnage so random and ubiquitous, it would be laughably absurd if it weren't so tragic.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.